This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Now listen to this.
You are listening to AWOL Radio on CKMS The Sound 100.3 FM in Waterloo. We are also podcasting on the Rabble Podcast Network at rabble.ca, and you can find AWOL on the web at peaceculture.org.
And we got AWOL Radio here, 100.3 Sound FM, soundfm.ca. Check us out on the web, grinderofmc.ca, and the Rabble Podcast Network, peaceculture.org, still down. Not going to lie to you, I don't care. Just don't care. I wish I could, but I don't. Smash the State Report, we're going to jump right into it. Exxon's tar sands oil spill shows risks of Enbridge's Line 9 project for Ontario and Quebec. This is posted up on CanadianProgressiveWorld.com. Last Friday's ExxonMobil Pegasus pipeline disaster in Mayflower, Arkansas, should warn Canadians against Enbridge's proposed Line 9 projects as environmental defense. The Pegasus pipeline ruptured and spilled more than 318,000 liters of tar sands oil into local neighborhood and near a lake. Local residents had to be evacuated. Environmental Defense, a nonpartisan environmental charity, says Line 9 poses serious risks to drinking water and the environment in neighborhoods, cities, and farms in Ontario and Quebec. And here's their statement. Following the serious rupture of ExxonMobil's Pegasus pipeline in Arkansas, Environmental Defense is calling for an urgent environmental assessment of Enbridge's request to reverse its Line 9 and ship more dangerous heavy oil through this aging pipeline, which runs through Ontario and Quebec. Enbridge's Line 9 proposal mirrors Exxon's actions on Pegasus and highlights the risks of the Line 9 project. On Friday, the Pegasus pipeline spilled at least 318,000 liters of tar sands oil and forced 22 families to evacuate their homes in the town of Mayflower, Arkansas. Quote, "The image of thick toxic oil gushing from a pipeline isn't something I want to see in Toronto or anywhere in Ontario or Quebec," said Adam Scott of Environmental Defense. Continuing, "We need to learn the lessons and look at the full risks to drinking water and our environment of Enbridge's Line 9 proposal," unquote. Enbridge is seeking permission to reverse its Line 9 pipeline, change what runs through the pipeline to heavy oil, which could include tar sands oil, and increase the amount of oil pushed through it each day by 60,000 barrels. In 2006, Exxon reversed the Pegasus pipeline and began sending tar sands oil through it, and increased the volume of oil by 30,000 barrels per day in 2009. Line 9 runs between Sarnia and Montreal through farms, cities, and neighborhoods, and crosses every Ontario river flowing into Lake Ontario, the drinking water for millions of Canadians. When spilled, tar sands diluted bitumen carries serious health risks and is harder and more expensive to clean up. Quote, "We have an opportunity to prevent another tar sands oil disaster from happening. Line 9 is three times the size of the Pegasus pipeline," Scott said, continuing, "It's time we learn that tar sands pipelines carry huge risks and few rewards," unquote. Environmental Defense is Canada's most effective environmental action organization that is nonpartisan. Check out environmentaldefense.ca. Following up on that, Kingston is reporting that the oil pipeline traversing rural Kingston has always carried the risk of leaking, and that risk will remain if changes to the pipeline use are approved, stated a report from senior city staff. In a report to the city's Rural Advisory Committee Tuesday night, Cynthia Beach, Commissioner of Sustainability and Growth, outlined some of the risks that could come with proposed changes to the use of Enbridge's Line 9B, a 76-centimeter diameter pipeline running between Hamilton area to Montreal. The pipeline, 35 kilometers of which runs across rural Kingston, currently carries light crude from Montreal to Sarnia. Actually, it currently carries nothing. It is allowed to carry light crude. Just one more city to jump on the growing list of cities that are concerned about Line 9. Of course, Hamilton, Toronto, Mississauga have already expressed their concern about this proposed reversal. Others are joining, Kingston the most recent. And we have one from tarsandsblockade.org, and we're going back to that Exxon spill. And it's dispatches from Exxon spill zone Day 2. We had hoped to interview some affected residents, but they were too sick to talk to us. They lived on a street immediately adjacent to the ones that were evacuated. Some homes, which were not evacuated, are actually closer to the spill than those which were. They're a couple of minutes by car, but they're only separated by a small grove of trees. The residents had not been contacted by Exxon or warned in any way about the dangers of tar sands. Both canceled the interview because they were feeling too sick to meet. Vomiting, headaches, dizziness, burning throats and coughing, the exact same symptoms felt by Kalamazoo residents after the Enbridge tar sand spill there in 2010. Evacuated residents are being housed in hotels. Exxon says it plans to rent homes for them. Non-evacuated residents who are actually closer to the spill site have been given nothing. No medical attention, no offers of alternate housing, no information. Exxon finally admitted today that what spilled from the pipeline was tar sands. Before that, they had admitted that it wasn't crude, but they were coy with the semantics. One evacuee who had asked about the distinction in meetings with Exxon told us that he'd been asked, "Well, what's your definition of tar sands?" We started the day at Lake Conway trying to get more footage of the neighborhoods and ecosystems affected by the spill. We got permission from a woman in the neighborhood to go into her backyard and take pictures from her dock, which goes into the body of water adjacent to Lake Conway, but not technically part of it, which was most affected by the spill. It's easier to see in the aerial video, which I was brought to attention to by the Glass Bead Collective out of New York, which was taken by a photojournalist who later became ill from exposure to the plumes of toxins. While we were taking pictures of the dead lake, two Mayflower police officers approached us. Once we explained that we had permission to be there, they left. Shortly afterward, two Faulkner County sheriffs approached us and told us to leave immediately or we would be arrested. At this point, the homeowners were outside and also explained that we were allowed to be there. The officer, Deputy Sweeney, said that they were too close to the scene and that we had to leave. Out of earshot of the residents, Sweeney told us to leave. We reiterated that the landowner gave us permission. Sweeney said that we didn't have his permission. We said that it was the landowner's property. He responded, "It's my property now." We returned to our car. It seemed like it would be okay to get more footage from the public road running between Lake Conway and a similar body of water. Two of us walked along the road with a camera and tripod. Officer Sweeney crossed the road and bodily grabbed one of us, telling us to leave immediately or be arrested. We said that it was a public road and that we weren't trespassing or breaking any laws. Sweeney said that it was his road today. We started filming the encounter, but Sweeney grabbed us again and forced the camera down. Afterward, we re-entered the woods to access the lake from a different angle. We were able to get near where some of the tar sand-soaked booms were anchored to trees. Some people calling them paper towels. Suddenly, we scared up a duck completely covered in tar sands. It was totally black, so there was no way we could guess at it the species. It was clearly distressed, flapping and stumbling rather than walking. Having talked with some graduate student biologists helping with the cleanup, we knew that the duck would likely die without help. The volunteers had explained that the tar sands caused more irritation than regular crude oil, and that the ducks they had worked with were completely red and blistered underneath their feathers. The oil also goes through their whole digestive tract. We immediately informed the Hawk Center, or Helping Arkansas Wild Critters, about the duck, but it fled into the water before we could catch it for cleaning and rehabilitation. Next, we went down the road to another cleanup site at the edge of the plaza, a parking lot for a Subway, Dollar Tree, and another businesses. A stream running behind the Subway was partially fenced off, and workers in yellow hazmat gear were milling around, occasionally doing something to adjust a pump or hose or hose down a stream bank. Subway and the rest of the businesses were open. Neither Exxon nor local authorities have been warning shoppers about the dangers of tar sands exposure. There isn't even a sign indicating what's going on. We decided to return to the wetland area because we heard that crews had begun digging. Driving past on the highway, we saw dozens of trucks, construction vehicles, and police vehicles along the frontage road. The crews were clearing trees and digging big pits. For tar sands, remediation means completely removing every living part of the ecosystem. Unlike crude, it sinks. Water is drained, forests are cleared, and the soil and sediments are scraped off in a somewhat grisly reenactment of the clear-cutting, strip-mining excavation of the Athabasca tar sands on the other end of this pipeline system. We wanted to see up close what was going on here. We turned down the frontage road to get closer. The road is public, and there were no signs indicating that it was closed to traffic. It became one way for a few hundred meters because of the line of trucks, but traffic was being waved through by flaggers. One of the sheriff cars pulled us over. A very large officer barked commands at us, checking identification and making the driver get out of the car for interrogation. At one point, the cop said to the driver, "If it were up to me, I wouldn't mind y'all being out here, but I'm getting paid a lot of money to keep you out of here." Unquote. The cop threatened the whole media crew with trespassing and interfering with a government operation. This seems strange, considering that Exxon and its contractors are overseeing every aspect of the spill, and no government agencies are at the scene. It's not surprising to us after seeing TransCanada hire local police officers as high-paid private security to guard our sustained 90-day tree sit against the Keystone XL pipeline. This was our sixth encounter with the police in 2 days of filming and trying to talk to residents. We had even been kicked out of the adjacent neighborhood, which was never evacuated. In four of them, the officers stressed, as police often do, that they understood what we were doing and or didn't have a problem with it, that they were just following orders. Remarkably, they were unapologetic and open about the fact that those orders came directly from Exxon. This is all standard practice when the dirty energy barons accidentally kill or sicken large numbers of people and eradicate whole ecosystems. Limit media coverage at all costs and deny everything. Once it becomes impossible to deny something, admit it and continue to deny everything else. We saw the same thing after over 1 million gallons of tar sands spilled into Kalamazoo, Michigan. And Enbridge initially denied that the pipeline was carrying tar sands and continues to insist that people's symptoms are not caused by the spill. No one knows how to clean up tar sands, and no one knows the extent of the health impacts. Mayflower, Arkansas is never going to be the same. One evacuee told us that several people don't want to move back. He said he's worried it's broken the community. Stay tuned for more updates as we have them. And again, that's from tarsandsblockade.org. And I again point folks to check out the, quote, amazing aerial footage of Arkansas Exxon oil spill. And that's how you search for it on YouTube. It's actually called the Amazing Aerial Footage of Arkansas Exxon Oil Spill. And it just shows a helicopter with a camera flying over the affected area. And it's massive. And you also see a couple suburb areas that the streets are black with tar sands. Spilled out of a pipeline similar to the Line 9 pipeline that may run through your community. Dun, dun, dun. And moving forward, some effects of those tar sands pollutants can be found in Lake Athabasca in the Athabasca River. Fish deformities have been linked to oil pollution in U.S. and Alberta. A renowned Alberta water scientist is urging the federal government to take action after he discovered deformities in fish in the Athabasca River, which is downriver from oil sands developments, which bear a striking resemblance to ones found in fish after spills in U.S. waters. University of Alberta ecologist Dr. David Schindler said the only way to know for sure which petrochemicals and in what concentrations cause the deformities is to do some more experimentation. Quote, I propose that the ELA site and the laboratory should be kept open to conduct these important experiments, which have implications for future effects of oil extraction and transport in or near both marine and freshwater ecosystems, unquote. Schindler wrote in a letter to Environment Minister Peter Kent and Fisheries Minister Keith Ashfield. The ELA was shuttered on March 31st after its funding was cut in last year's budget. A Department of Fisheries and Oceans... The Department of Fisheries and Oceans says it's in negotiations with other parties to take over the operations of one-of-the-kind facility. The government will save $2 million a year by offloading the government laboratory made up of 58 small pristine lakes. Yes, that's right. Save an entire $2 million. I'm sure overtime charges from the RCMP will trump that in a couple protests, or when they're trying to infiltrate activist groups or Idle No More groups. Schindler cited a number of studies that looked into the aspects of oil and chemical contamination on fish after the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska and the Deepwater Horizon accident in the Gulf of Mexico, as well as the lower Athabasca River. He included photos of fish from the Athabasca with two tails, bulging eyeballs, and gaping sores. Quote, in both the Gulf of Mexico and the Athabasca River, the high incidence of malformations and grotesque appearances of some of the fish make consumers reluctant to eat them, wrote Schindler. He added that there was a threat to the Gulf of Mexico's commercial fishery and the Athabasca's subsistence fishery. Schindler's eureka moment came last week when he was forwarded an article about a study done on fish in the Gulf of Mexico. Quote, I was really struck with how similar some of those malformations were, and of course, they'd come up in only a little over a year since that Gulf spill, Schindler told the CBC. The timing of the letter is hard to ignore. It comes hard on the heels of the ELA's closure, with a September 1st deadline looming for Ottawa to find a new operator or return the property to a province of Ontario. Schindler is a vocal member of the advocacy group Save the ELA. Asked if this was just a ploy to keep the facility open, Schindler responded, quote, that's exactly what they said when I proposed that acid rain was a problem in 1974. Moving forward. CBAN, the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network, has released a new report which warns of the inevitable contamination if GM alfalfa is released in Ontario. Quote, we can clearly see how farmers will pay the heavy cost of this inevitable contamination, said Ontario organic sheep and vegetable farmer Ann Slater, member of the National Farmers Union, continuing, the only way to stop contamination from GM alfalfa is to keep it off the market, unquote. Alfalfa is an important crop for dairy farming in Ontario, as well as for livestock farmers and vegetable and field crop producers. Some Ontario farmers also save alfalfa seed. The report details the role of seeds, pollen, and volunteer or feral plants in the predicted contamination of non-GMO alfalfa from GM alfalfa. If released, GM alfalfa would be the first GM perennial crop introduced in Canada. Quote, while the conditions for contamination in eastern Canada differ from those in western Canada, where alfalfa seed is produced, contamination in Ontario is assured, as are the economic costs to farmers, said Lucy Schratt of the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network. Quote, our report documents the many means by which farmers can expect to see contamination from GM alfalfa. Contamination is assured. The only question is how long it will take and which will be the first of primary means of gene escape, said Tarni Chopra, also with the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network. Quote, this report puts an end to the discussion around coexisting with GM alfalfa. It's just not possible, said Philip Woodhouse, president of the Ontario Grey County NFU Local 344, who also attended an October 2012 meeting of the Canadian Seed Trade Association, where the industry attempted to construct a coexistence plan to pave way for GM alfalfa. Quote, Forage Genetics International appears willing to sacrifice the livelihoods of Ontario farmers to get their product on the market somewhere in Canada. Quote, no farmer can shield themselves from this genetic pollution. Does anyone really believe that introducing GM alfalfa in eastern Canada will protect prairie farmers from this contamination? Added Woodhouse. The National Farmers Union has called for consumers to support farmers in a day of action to stop alfalfa on April 9th. Ontario farmers have organized protest rallies in 12 communities outside of constituency offices of federal members of parliament, as well as outside the variety registration office of the Canadian Food Inspection Agency in Ottawa, where a final rubber stamp to release Roundup Ready alfalfa is expected any day. There are also 11 rallies confirmed in support of Ontario farmers happening in towns in BC, Alberta, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan at the office of the Minister of Agriculture, and in Quebec and Nova Scotia. Check out more on cban.ca/April 9th. And if you're in Waterloo region, you can check out the protest in front of Peter Braid's office in Uptown Waterloo on the 9th at noon. Talking about the inevitable contamination or spread of genetic things from one side of Canada to the other. The mountain pine beetle is poised to ravage eastern Canada. Billions of mountain pine beetles from BC are expected to devastate forests in Ontario, Quebec, and the Maritime provinces as they munch their way east over the next two decades, scientists predict in a new documentary. Quote, most every scientist studying the beetle feels that it's inevitable, said David York, the filmmaker behind The Beetles Are Coming, which airs on CBC's TV's The Nature of Things. Quote, it's going to happen and we're going to have to adapt, unquote. The rice grain-sized mountain beetle has already wiped out an area of BC's lodgepole pine forest as large as Nova Scotia and New Brunswick combined. It has since crossed the Rocky Mountains into Alberta and is heading for Saskatchewan. The mountain pine beetle is native to northern BC, where it has long played an important role in the renewal of lodgepole pine forests, York said. Quote, the beetle's job is to take out 80 to 100-year-old overmature pine trees, thin out the canopy, and allow room for nutrients for younger trees to grow, unquote. Lodgepole pines have evolved defenses against the beetles, which have also traditionally been kept in check by harsh, cold winters, limiting their damage to small outbreaks every 25 years or so. York's film, based on a book, Empire of the Beetle, by Calgary writer Andrew Nicky Foruk, explores how climate change has thrown the natural balance of beetle-lodgepole-pine relationships out of whack, and looks at the serious consequences for both humans and natural ecosystems. Warmer winters have allowed beetles' populations to explode and wipe out millions of hectares of BC forests. The beetles have expanded their range into Alberta and jackpine forests that have no defenses against this invader. The effects on forest ecosystems and the forestry industry have been devastating. York said the story is really an illustration about the impact of climate change. Quote, nobody would have expected that a simple degree and a half of warming in the interior of BC would unleash a beetle outbreak in 18 million hectares worth of pine forest, he said. Well, some people did. He added that while it's relatively easy to predict certain effects of climate change, such as drier weather that leads to drought, quote, it's all of unanticipated effects that are going to be what bites us in the ass, unquote. And it's the unanticipated effects that we really got to think about. It's the systemic effects. It's the cumulative effects. It's what happens when one thing is done after another to destroy the ability of the ecosystem to respond to impacts. It's called complex systems, but it's really not that complex. A piece from Submedia TV, Algonquins Fight for Their Land. And it's posted up. It's posted up by Barrier Lake Solidarity, produced this video to help bring attention to the current struggle of the Algonquins of Barrier Lake. The Canadian government's attempt to take control of the community through an obscure provision of the Indian Act, known as Section 74, the video is narrated by Barrier Lake spokesman Norman Machawan. Check out barrierlakesolidarity.org for more info.
This is Barrier Lake, 3 hours north of Ottawa. Our Algonquin community of 400 people is fighting for control of our land, our government, and our way of life. We call ourselves Mijikunapkuinik, the Algonquins of Barrier Lake, and our way of life is inseparable from the land we live on. It includes knowledge of traditional medicines, harvesting, and craft making, and our relationship with the animals through hunting, fishing, and trapping. This is the land where we dream and where our ancestors live. Our traditional system of government is called the Mijikunapkuinik Anishinaabe Onakinigewin. The selection of our leaders is governed by this code. For example, elders undertake what's called a blazing process where they select and nominate potential leaders. Potential leaders must live on the territory, have connection to the land, and speak the language. Then community assemblies are held, where leaders that have been nominated are approved by the community. It is a direct democracy. Leaders must always have the consent of the governed. Barrier Lake live on unceded Algonquin territory. We have never signed away our land rights. Our land is rich with resources. Every year approximately $100 million is made off the land through forestry, hydroelectricity, and tourism. We do not see a cent. We fought for and won an agreement in 1991 that was supposed to help us protect our traditional way of life and protect the medicine, spawning, and sacred areas. The agreement was also intended to give us a modest share of the revenue generated from our lands, which could then be used for sustainable economic development. The agreement was called an environmental trailblazer and a model of coexistence. 20 years later, and the governments are still refusing to implement it. Our peaceful protests have been met with tear gas, arrest, police brutality. The government has tried everything to crush our spirit and our will to fight for our rights. Economic sabotage, internal political interference, and PR campaigns spreading misinformation. This summer, Canada attempted to destroy our traditional government, their latest tactic to undermine our connection to our lands and our ability to fight for our rights, by using a racist and paternalistic section of the Indian Act, Section 74. They have imposed a foreign system of government on our community. The community did not want these Indian Act Band Council elections. 200 people from the community signed a community resolution in support of our traditional government. So it's no surprise only 10 people sent in nomination ballots. Based on only these 10 ballots, a band council was put in power, consisting mostly of people that do not live in the Barrier Lake community. That's the government's idea of democracy. As feared, this band council has already been making deals with forestry companies. The government must be relieved to get a strong traditional government out of the way. But we will not back down. We will never back down. Our parents and grandparents did not back down, and that's why our land is still protected. The falsely nominated Indian Act Chief has since resigned in solidarity. Widu Kushnan, Mushkizim Gun, Widu Kadadun, Modu Siach, Nishnabek, Mamu Kawi Widu Kaziach, Kajik Pio Damak, Ndakinan, Mamu, Nishnabio Nakinigewin. Support us. Support is strong when we are united, native or non-native. We will protect our land and our customs. Our hearts and minds are with our future generations. There will always be Anishinaabe who live and protect the land.
And again, that's Algonquin's fight for their land up in Barrier Lake. Check out that video. You can check it out on barrierlakesolidarity.org. I found it from submedia.tv/stimulator. And following up with Indigenous rights and sovereignty, from cornwallfreenews.com, the results of a cross-border smuggling study conducted and released by the McDonald Laurier Institute this week is misleading and unfortunately cannot be considered objective or accurate due to its lack of fair and thorough research. The Border Integrity, Illicit Tobacco, and Canada's Security 40-page study takes a broad look at the issues of smuggling in the 401 corridor. Quote, while components of the study are accurate, the overall position seems to be pushing an agenda using all too familiar scare tactics, unquote, said MCA Grand Chief Mike Kenantakaran Mitchell. Continuing, for example, there is no evidence that tobacco smuggling is in this area contributes in any form to terrorism or mafia crime. What we are asking now is, who asked for this study? Who paid for this study? Based on the final report, it seems quite apparent that there is an agenda being pushed, unquote. The Mackenzie Laurier Institute study was completed without any contact with Akwesasne leadership until plans to release it were underway. Researchers failed to meet with Akwesasne community members or any officials who have knowledge or of the historical aspect of the tobacco trade, the political relationship between First Nations and Canada, or Akwesasne's own police statistics. Researchers relied on internet articles published by Canadian media, but did not use any Akwesasne media sources or publications as reference. All this contributes to a one-sided report that is meant to scare the federal government into taking extreme measures to fight a non-extreme political and economic issue. The MLI hosted a conference on March 26, 2013, to present the outcome of the study, and the MCA leaders were invited to attend. This communication was the first contact made by MLI regarding the study. Despite many inaccuracies and poor research found in the report, Akwesasne leaders remain hopeful that Canadian officials will sit down with them to discuss solutions to the political and economic issues of the tobacco trade. Quote, what we have seen thus far from the federal government doesn't really resemble any degree of support for resolving the problem, but rather a harsh execution of laws, said Grand Chief Mitchell, continuing, More manpower, harsher sentencing, more equipment dollars spent. We have Ontario and Quebec at the table to explore alternative economic opportunities and to examine the option of legalizing tobacco manufacturing and legitimizing any other trade. We are waiting for the federal government to join us. If opportunities were provided for our youth in terms of promising careers in their home of Akwesasne, and if regulations were established to provide an alternative route for those in the tobacco business, we could see this issue move into a promising direction, unquote. One positive aspect of the report is the author's suggestion that any solution will require all affected parties at the table, including First Nations leaders. This is precisely what Akwesasne leadership has been asking for since the 1990s, and, well, probably much more before that. We're now going to a piece posted up on upworthy.com. It's a piece of spoken word from the Minneapolis Spoken Word or Slam Festival, and it's awesome. Here on the Smash the State Report, we have Dear Straight People, We Have to Talk.
Dear straight people, who do you think you are? Do you have to make it so obvious that I make you uncomfortable? Why do I make you uncomfortable? Do you know that makes me uncomfortable? Now we both uncomfortable. Dear straight people, you're the reason we stay in the closet. You're the reason we even have a closet. I don't like closets, but you made the living room an unshared space and I'm feeling like a guest in my own house. Dear straight people, sexuality and gender, two different things, combined in many different ways. If you mismatch your socks, you understand. Dear hip-hop, why are you fascinated with discovering gay rappers? Gay people rap, just like gay people ride bikes and eat tofu. Dear straight people, I don't think God is a sexual orientation, but if she were straight, she'd be a dope ally. Why else would she invent rainbows? Dear straight women, I mean, straight women. Leave me the fuck alone. Dear straight men, if I'm flirting with you, it's because I think it's funny. Just laugh. Dear straight people, I'm tired of proving that my love is authentic, so I'm calling for reparations on your ass. When did you realize you were straight? Who taught you? Did it happen because your parents are divorced? Did it happen because your parents are not divorced? Did it happen because you sniffed too much glue in fifth grade? Dear straight people, why do I have to prove my love is authentic? Why do I have to prove my love is authentic? Why do I have to prove my love is authentic? Why do you have to stare at me when I'm holding my girlfriend's hand like I'm about to rob you? Dear straight people, you make me want to fucking rob you. Dear straight allies, thank you. More, please. Dear straight bullies, you're right. We don't have the same values. You kill everything that's different. I preserve it. Tell me, what happened to Jose Mercado, Zakiya Gunn, Lawrence King? What happened to the souls alienated in between too many high school walls who planned the angles of their deaths in math class, who imagined their funerals as ticker tape parades, who thought the afterlife was more like an after party? Did you notice that hate is alive and well in too many lunchrooms, taught in the silence of too many teachers, passed down like secondhand clothing from too many parents? Dear queer young girl, I see you. You don't want them to see you, so you change the pronouns in your love poems to him instead of her. I used to do that. Dear straight people, you make young poets make bad edits. Dear straight people, kissing my girlfriend in public without looking to see who's around is a luxury I do not fully have yet. But tonight, I am drunk in my freedom. Grab her hand on the busiest street corner in Philadelphia. Zip my fingers into hers and press our lips firmly until we melt their stares into a standing ovation. Imagine that we are in a sea of smiling faces, even when we're not. And when we're not, we start shoveling, digging deep into each other's eyes. We say, hey, baby, can't nothing stop this tonight. Because tonight, this world is broken. And we're the only thing that's gonna keep it together. Okay.
Yeah. That was up on upworthy.com. An awesome, awesome piece there. Really like it. This one up from julianickham.wordpress.com. CAS gets hit hard. Today's local anti-poverty protesters join forces with Canada Court Watch and Voices to deliver a message to potential CAS foster parents at CAS Foster Parent Recruiting Night. While people were picketing outside, several activists set up shop inside the CIS recruiting event with signs and pamphlets explaining the true nature of CIS and how it is used to target poor parents and steal their children. Armed with several recent newspaper articles about corruption and CIS crimes against children, as well as information, many potential foster parents were shown a different side to this nice organization. Potential foster parents were appalled to find out that CIS is a for-profit organization with no government oversight that has been granted tremendous powers. As we engaged in discussion, we were approached by the organizer of the event who said we could stay and participate, since to my knowledge, it was a public event. We agreed to engage and discuss matters civilly, and that all we wanted to do is raise our concerns and issues. A bit later, we were approached by the CIS boss, who was nice and sweet as honey, when she asked us to leave and said that we could leave our information at the front desk. We left causing no fuss, only to see a total opposite side to her when we were out of earshot from the potential recruits. This makes us wonder what children go through when no one is watching. We then joined those picketing and handing out information outside, and many passerbys were supportive. All in all, this was a successful demonstration in action, as people turned away when they saw the picket. Most importantly, we exposed the truth to these potential recruits through hard, solid facts. And it's important to remember, for potential foster parents, to remain critical of CIS. Remain critical of the impact CIS has on families and understand how CIS makes money. Understand that foster parenting is a very important role to play, but also know the potential impacts that CIS has on families that you will be brought into if you join that system. And some news from Electronic Intifada and York University. Well, a boycott resolution has been passed by York University's undergraduate student union. 2 weeks ago, on Thursday, in Toronto's York University Undergraduate Student Union, the York Federation of Students passed a resolution in favor of a Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The York Federation of Students is the largest student movement in Canada. The resolution demands that the university's administration, quote, abides by the BDS call, unquote, and urges York to, quote, withdraw its investments from Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, Amphenol, and other companies that are selling weapons and military equipment to Israel, unquote. Last November, the Graduate Students' Union at York passed a similar resolution during the 8 days of Israeli attacks on Gaza. When the Graduate Student Union's resolution passed, York student activists announced they were working to encourage the Undergraduate Students' Union to endorse the BDS motion. In the last 3 weeks, student unions and governments at the University of California at Riverside and the University of California at San Diego, and now York University, have passed comprehensive boycott resolutions urging their administrations to stop investing in companies which profit from Israel's military occupation. Thursday's press relief from Students Against Israeli Apartheid, or SIA, at York University states in full. On this International Day Against Racial Discrimination, in a historic vote at the largest student union in Canada, York University's Undergraduate Students Union, the York Federation of Students, voted overwhelmingly in favor of a resolution to endorse the global campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israeli apartheid. The resolution was drafted in response to the 2005 Palestinian Civil Society call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel as a means to pressure it to comply with international law and to end its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, allow Palestinian refugees their internationally guaranteed rights to return to their homes and villages, and grant equal rights to Palestinian citizens of Israel. With 18 votes for and 2 opposed, the board of the York Federation of Students passed the resolution to endorse the BDS campaign, as well as the demand that York University abide by the BDS call, specifically urging the university to withdraw its investments from Northrop Grumman, BAE Systems, Amphenol, and other companies that are selling weapons and military equipment to Israel. Quote, "The oppression of the Palestinian people at the hands of the Israeli state is not some far-off issue that we can choose to ignore. We are already deeply implicated in the human rights violation of the Israeli state through our investments in the above-mentioned companies. We do not have the privilege to remain neutral on this issue, unquote, said Students Against Israeli Apartheid York Collective member Huda Al-Sarraj. In November of this academic year, Saya York achieved its first BDS success with the passing of a BDS motion at the York University Graduate Student Association. Saya York now hopes to bring its demand for divestment to the York University administration by lobbying for the implementation of a socially responsible investment policy. With the support of the GSA, the YFS, as well as the TAs, GAs, and Contract Faculty Union QP3903, which passed a BDS motion in 2006, Saya York will now demand an end to the investment of university funds into companies that profit from violations of international law and human rights. Check that out on electronicintifada.net. And from icantrelaxingreece.wordpress.com, Golden Dawn candidate has been thrown into the sea at the harbor of Chania. Stelios Vlamakis, Golden Dawn candidate, was thrown into the sea at the Venetian port of Chania in Crete by local residents reacting to the attacks against immigrants and other residents by Golden Dawn supporters at the center of Chania. The incident took place on Tuesday evening. Golden Dawn members were having fun till 6:30 in the evening at a cafeteria at Apokorunu Street in downtown Chania. Around 10 Golden Dawn members had gotten extremely drunk since the early afternoon, singing various anthems and giving the Nazi salute. The place where they were having fun is just a few meters away from a football fan club and around 70 meters away from the offices of the local Communist Party of Greece that are located on the same street. Leaving from the cafeteria at around 7 p.m. and moving towards the Venetian harbor, the Golden Dawn members attacked against two immigrants, according to witnesses, and came to verbal confrontation with a teacher. A member of the Board County Department of the Civil Servants Confederation. Arriving at the harbor and while keeping up this kind of behavior, at the same time that the police were absent, the Golden Dawn members came to a dispute with store patrons and harbor visitors. Following these, people from the anarchist scene gathered together at the Fountain Square of the Venetian Harbor and scuffled with them. During a scuffle, a Golden Dawn candidate was thrown into the sea and two other members of the organization, a 43 and 23-year-old, were injured and taken to the Chania Hospital to receive first aid. Then came the police, who arrested four members of Golden Dawn, plus, unfortunately, the teacher and a waiter. At the police station, the teacher filed a lawsuit against the two members of the fascist Golden Dawn, accusing them of abuse, while the GD members sued the young teacher as well as a journalist of Chania that had not even been at the spot of the incident. Also, the GD members filed a lawsuit against four youths, accusing them of the beating. Finally, with oral order of the prosecutor, the arrested were released. According to testimonies from neighbors, Golden Dawn members also attacked an officer from the NATO military force and his colleagues rushed to his defense. Meanwhile, after the fight, members of the Communist Party marched downtown to protest the presence of Golden Dawn. Golden Dawn out of everywhere. Die, Nazis, die. Speaking of, you know, getting rid of fascists, let's get rid of the CBSA and Minister Vic Taves. There's a petition to demand that Border Security, a reality show, be canceled, put up on rabble.ca. We talked about it in the last few weeks. We talked about this petition. Keep signing it. We're almost at 25,000 signatures. In mid-March, Canada Border Services Agency officers raided construction sites in East Vancouver and detained an estimated 29 workers. That raid was filmed for the reality TV series Border Security, which is produced by Force 4 Entertainment and Shaw Media. The Vancouver Sun reported at that time, quote, Harshawalia, a spokeswoman for the Known as Illegal, a national not-for-profit organization that advocates for migrant justice, said, many of those detained are in the process of getting work permits, but because they are not allowed to work while they wait, many will take jobs under the table so they can support their families, unquote. Vic Taves, Harper's Minister of Public Safety, has defended the program and a CBSA document says the show is, quote, a valuable opportunity to promote important messages about Canada's commitment to border security and to give profile to the agency as a professional and effective law enforcement agency, unquote. The Global Mail has also reported that the show, quote, received funding through the Canadian Film or Production Tax Credit, a federal program run through Canadian Heritage, and the BC Production Services Tax Credit, unquote. Vancouver-based Council of Canadians organizer Harshep Graywall has stated, quote, the CBSA and the government should be held accountable for their participation in this disgusting reality TV show, which is profiting from the violation of privacy of migrant workers and the suffering of families. The last few years have seen the demonization of various groups, environmentalists, activists, and Indigenous communities by the federal government. Now this TV show is singling out refugees and migrants for public amusement. It's wrong, unquote. To sign the petition calling for the cancellation of the reality TV show, please go to change.org/cancelbordersecurity. And moving forward, we have a report from VancouverMediaCoop.ca. Hunger striker Homeless Dave has lost a pound a day over the last 2 weeks at a weigh-in in Vancouver City Hall. A couple days ago, Dave tipped the scales 14 pounds lighter than he was when he launched his open-ended hunger strike against gentrification in the downtown east side. A thinner but still upbeat Dave slipped a letter with his demands through Gregor Robertson's door, the mayor being out when Dave and his 50 supporters dropped in. Dave's three main demands are social housing on the Sequel 138 condo site, housing and a wellness center at the old cop shop at 312 Main Street, and declare the downtown east side a social justice zone with city-instituted policies to make it happen. Check out dteshungerstrike.blogspot.com or dteshungerstrike on Facebook. And there's some great pictures there. And what's really important to recognize here is Homeless Dave's hunger strike out in Vancouver comes at the same time that actions have been taking place in to demand opening of more shelter space. For the last couple of days, OCAP and their supporters and other anti-poverty activists have been in Toronto, in City Council, showing their presence and their support to open up more shelter space. Well, in an awesome victory today, might have been yesterday, in a recent awesome victory, Toronto City Council has looked at their policy about the capacity of shelter space in Toronto and have opened up more shelter space. It's a very important victory, and it shows that public participation and getting out there, putting your body out there, more than just an email, more than just a phone call, but going to City Council and demanding what you want. If you do it with a large enough group, you'll get it, if that group is directed towards social justice. Talking about a large enough group, let's get a large enough group on May Day. Right across the country, right around the world. And check this one out in Toronto. I know there might be a Kitchener March, but No One Is Illegal, toronto.noonelegal.org, has put out their call out for May Day actions. And here is that read. For 7 years, you have marched on May Day to celebrate and invigorate migrant justice struggles in Toronto. On May 1st, 2013, let's take to the streets once again to build a solidarity city. Solidarity City is a unified struggle for respective Indigenous sovereignty, status for all, an end to imperialism and environmental destruction, an end to austerity and attacks on the poor, and continued resistance against patriarchy, racism, ableism, and homo and transphobia. Pipelines, tankers, mines, and so-called development projects are being forced onto the lands of Indigenous nations. Harper, like every prime minister who came before him, refuses to respect the sovereignty of Indigenous peoples and continues to neglect his treaty obligations, as seen in Omnibus Bill C-45. In the face of this and more, land defenders across Turtle Island continue to resist in a powerful and inspiring ways. As we look towards an exciting summer of actions and resistance fueled by the Idle No More movement and defenders of the land, this May Day, let us honor all ongoing decolonization struggles and commit to continuing support for Indigenous sovereignty. This past year has seen implementation of Bill C-31, dubbed the Refugee Exclusion Act, further criminalizing migrants and expanding the detention and deportation machine. Jason Kenney announced the creation of a designated countries of origin list, a racist two-tiered system under which refugees get fewer rights based on their place of birth. This past November, many of us honored our communities and confronted Minister Kenney when he showed up in Toronto. On May 1st, let us take to the streets to build community alliances and resistance once again. Exploitative worker programs continue to expand and many migrant workers continue to meet deportation, injuries, and in some cases, death. Workers are being forced to pay thousands of dollars to get jobs in Canada, for which entire families go into debt, yet no provisions exist for status on landing. Since Harper came into power, over 72,000 people have been locked up in immigration detention. In December, we rallied in solidarity with security certificate detainees Mohamed Majoub, Mohamed Harket, and Mahmoud Jabala, and all those locked up in immigration detention. This May Day let us take to the streets to end detention and deportation, and to call for freedom to move, freedom to stay, and freedom to return. On February 21st, Toronto City Hall reaffirmed its promise to providing services to residents without full immigration status. We will continue to build a solidarity city where communities work together to ensure justice and dignity for all residents. The history of Access Without Fear in Toronto is a long one, and on May Day, let us march to celebrate our victories and commit to continued struggle. In the face of austerity, climate destruction, colonial and capitalist wars and interventions here and across the world that push people out of their homes, let us fight for status for all. Status for all is the struggle for self-determination, just livelihood, housing, food, education, healthcare, childcare, shelter, justice and dignity for all people with or without immigration status. Coordinated by a coalition of community groups including Known as Illegal Toronto, May 1st Movement and Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Endorsers include the Association of Part-Time Undergraduate Students, CAMPSIS, Casa Salvador Allende, Educators for Peace and Justice, Health for All, Maggie's Toronto Sex Workers Action Project, Oprah York, Rhythms of Resistance Toronto Socialist Project, Toronto Haiti Action Committee, the Toronto New Socialists, Women Coordinating Committee for a Free Wamapu, and more. To endorse the event, check out knownaslegal.org. And spread the word about this event. Let's make May Day in Toronto a huge one this year. And before we go to break, a decade into the Iraq War, campaign for war resistors continues. And this is a piece posted up on socialist.ca. 10 years ago, the United States redoubled its effort in the destruction and occupation of Iraq, moving from sanctions back to bombings and killings. 9 years ago, the people across Canada started welcoming a new generation of U.S. soldiers of conscience from another illegal and immoral U.S. war. The War Resisters Support Campaign is an intergenerational mix of Americans who have emigrated during the U.S. war in Vietnam, the Canadians who helped them, and those who have grown up being proud of that legacy. Together, the campaign has made every effort to uphold the rights of U.S. war resistors to refuse service to military and a country which will not honor international law and a soldier's obligation to refuse to commit war crimes and to participate in illegal wars. The struggle to allow U.S. war resistors from Iraq and Afghanistan to settle in Canada has not been easy and is not over. The campaign has successfully engaged this issue in three ways, providing the means for war resistors and their families to economically and socially integrate in their new communities, connecting them with legal counsel to navigate the immigration refugee system as political refugees, and become involved in national political system in order to have the federal government create a provision for immigration for war resistors. The War Resistors Support Campaign has been able to identify and promote broad support for war resistors, quantified in a 2008 poll that said two-thirds of Canadians think the war resistors should become permanent residents. Parliament has twice voted to stop the deportation of war resistors and let them stay. There has also been international support for war resistors, from Vietnam resistor Ron Kovic to Archbishop Desmond Tutu. But under the conservative government of Stephen Harper, with Jason Kenney as Minister of Citizenship and Immigration, this democratic will has been thwarted multiple times through ignoring Parliament and unethical interference in the refugee system. Jason Kenney labeled war resisters as bogus refugee claimants, an allegation opposed by the Canadian Council for Refugees as giving, quote, the strong appearance of political interference, unquote. Kenney then institutionalized this prejudice with Operational Bulletin 202, which labels war resisters criminally inadmissible. According to Amnesty International, it is a violation of international refugee law to suggest that deserters are automatically inadmissible to Canada. Amnesty International believes that Operational Bulletin 202 misstates the law and seeks to intrude on the independence of both the IRB members and immigration officers, unquote. The struggle continues through the determination of war resisters, the diligent work of their lawyers, and the ongoing campaign of their supporters. Federal courts have ruled 11 times since 2008 that the IRB have made errors in the cases of war resistors. Most recently, the federal court found that the U.S. court-martial system fails to comply with basic fairness requirements found in Canadian and international law. At any point, the Minister of Citizenship and Immigration can create a provision for a group of people to be provisionally admitted to Canada with permanent resident status. It's been proven that the U.S. military court-martial system is unfair and that war resistors who've been to Canada have been punished more harshly. Join the campaign in defending our collective right to peace and freedom and providing a sanctuary for war resistors in Canada once and for all. That's up on socialist.ca. A decade into the Iraq War, campaign for war resistors continues. And let's go to a song here on AWOL Radio. I kind of like it. Kaylon Wee, this is our song.
Across this great land, joining hand in hand, united we will stand. Drums raised up above, sharing our love, oh yes we can.
Smash the State continues. We got four pieces for you. And the first is posted up on QuebecProtest.com. 10 reasons not to provide a protest itinerary to the police. Remember, Smash the State report. Number one, the right to protest exists. The Canadian and Quebec Charter of Rights and Freedoms, both documents that protect the fundamental rights governing relations between the state and individuals, guarantee the right to protest as it pertains to freedom of conscience, thought, belief, opinion, and expression. These charters also protect the freedom of peaceful assembly and association, which are the ways in which this form of expression manifests itself. 2. Police everywhere, trust nowhere. Transmitting the itinerary of a protest to the police implies a process of negotiation between the protest organizers and the police. However, it often happens, and this increases in step with the escalation of police repression, that the relationship of trust inherent in this negotiation is found lacking. 3. Why legitimize a negotiation process from which we clearly emerge on the losing end? The refusal to submit an itinerary is a strategic choice. Insofar as experience has shown us that the police will try to impose a route that would undermine the impact of the protest by preventing it from, for example, directing the procession through an important commercial artery or in front of a highly symbolic place, yet one that interferes too much with public order, according to officials. Without an agreement, the police can even refuse to authorize a protest. Not submitting an itinerary is tantamount to refusing to acknowledge a process of negotiation with the state from which we will leave the loser. Number 4. And what about spontaneous protests? Let's call last year's Pots and Pans protests in which Pauline Marois participated. Today they would end up in a police kettle. Or again, imagine that we find out that in the late morning, that premiere will be at Montreal City Hall later in the evening, and that we decide it would be the perfect moment to demonstrate our dissatisfaction with the government's austerity policies. Well, Municipal Bylaw P6 would prohibit this. Article 2.1, quote, does not foresee cases where circumstances do not allow for timely communication, unquote, with the head of the police force, as in the case in spontaneous protests, continuing, this obligation has the effect of limiting, even inhibiting, the creation of spontaneous protests in response to conflicts of any kind, including labor conflicts, which constrains the right of freedom to expression and association, Barreau du Québec said in May 16. Number 5. You haven't done anything wrong, but you are guilty nonetheless. By claiming that any individual who participates in a protest without a previously disclosed itinerary is infringing the law, Bylaw P6 establishes a principle of collective penal responsibility. Our mere presence proves guilt, even if we had not participated in the organization of the protest ourselves. Moreover, Bylaw P6 implies that protesters are fully informed at all times. Yet how often have we participated in a protest without knowing exactly who organized it? Probably quite often. How often have we verified if the protest itinerary had been handed over to the police? Probably never. And how often, either at the beginning or throughout a protest, has it been impossible to understand what has been said over the police megaphone? Probably quite often. But it doesn't matter, given that our mere presence makes us guilty of breaking the law. 6. If police officers wish to arrest us, they will arrest us. Given that the police is an integral part of the political machinery, it obeys the government's political leanings and goals. When the government decides that the social crisis is behind us, all pretexts are fighting for preventing protests, which are indications of civil discontentment. If not, via Bylaw P6, the police can always invoke Article 500.1 of the Highway Safety Code of traffic obstruction, as it has done many times since March 15, 2011. Basically, providing an itinerary does not protect us from being arrested individually or massively. 7. If the cops want to rough us up, they'll rough us up. Providing the police with an itinerary or participating in an authorized protest does not guarantee that the police will respect our rights. How often have the cops pushed us around with their shields because we weren't moving fast enough while they were charging? How often have we been hit with clubs and insults in an attempt to intimidate us or to push us towards a kettle? How often have we seen the sky fill up with tear gas and felt our throats and eyes swell with irritation without having committed any action whatsoever, without having received any warning whatsoever? How often have we heard the sound grenades explode nearby in the midst of a calm and peaceful crowd? Let us rethink the times our rights and freedoms were restricted. Can providing an itinerary truly protect us from the police? Number 8. Violence? What violence? The police state that Bylaw P6 is a response to protest violence, yet the large majority of protests are incredibly peaceful, even when they are confronted with police violence. Furthermore, if the goal is to provide the few possible misdemeanors that can sometimes be committed during the protest, you won't get there by submitting a route. Misdemeanors can happen whether the itinerary is divulged or not, and in that event, other municipal rules as well as the criminal code exists. Number 9. Direct democracy. Who is responsible for a protest? The Maple Spring enabled many to familiarize themselves with the idea of a decision-making process which seeks to be horizontal and non-hierarchical. To leave the responsibility and authority to choose a protest route and to negotiate with the police up to only a handful of individuals and to expect that the itinerary be respected no matter what happens is contrary to the spirit of collegiality that were responsible for the success of the night of neighborhood protests, or casseroles, for example. Number 10. We will not back down in the face of police intimidation. No matter what the police states, boastful of repression, the goal of P6 and the mass arrests is to dissuade people from protesting by creating a climate not of security, but of fear, and by criminalizing the expression of discontent and dissidence. As such, when the police attempt to justify resorting to P6, a so-called demand on the part of the citizens to stop the protests was invoked. The problem is therefore not to disclose of the itinerary in itself, but rather the very occurrence of the protests. In short, Bylaw P6 privileges public order to the detriment of freedom of expression. To submit to it would make us complicit in a dangerous erosion of democracy in Quebec. And we can extend that if they try to put anything else like that in the rest of Canada. Check it out on quebecprotest.com. It was originally posted up in French, anonymously. And one more piece here on Smash the State Report. And it's a piece that was written, let's call it, a while ago. And it's the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto. And I've been doing a lot of work recently on internet security, on network security, on cryptography, on the understanding of creating things that are not accessible to the so-called powers that be. Well, this piece written in 1992... was prophetic. It seems to have come true, many of the things that we're talking about. Well, I'm going to read it. Cypherpunks of the world, several of you at the physical cypherpunks gathering yesterday in Silicon Valley requested that more of the material passed out in meetings be available electronically to the entire readership. Here is the crypto manifesto I read at the 1992 founding meeting. It dates back to the mid-1988 and was distributed to some like-minded techno-anarchists at the Crypto 88 conference, and then again at the Hackers conference of that year. I later gave talks at Hackers on this in 1989 and 1990. There are a few things I'd change, but for historical reasons, I'll just leave it as is. Some of these terms may be unfamiliar to you. I hope the crypto glossary I just distributed will help. This is from Tim May, posted up on activism.net. The Crypto Anarchist Manifesto. A specter is haunting the modern world, the specter of crypto anarchy. Computer technology is on the verge of providing the ability for individuals and groups to communicate and interact with each other on a totally anonymous manner. Two persons may exchange messages, conduct business, and negotiate electronic contacts without ever knowing the true name or legal identity of the other. Interactions over networks will be untraceable via extensive rerouting in encrypted packets and tamper-proof boxes, which implement cryptographic protocols with nearly perfect assurance against any tampering. Reputations will be of central importance. far more important than dealings in even the credit ratings of today. These developments will alter completely the nature of government regulations, the ability to tax and control economic interactions, the ability to keep information secret, and will even alter the nature of trust and reputation. The technology for this revolution, and it surely will be both a social and economic revolution, has existed in theory for the past decade. The methods are based upon public key encryption, zero-knowledge interactive proof systems, and various software protocols for interaction, authentication, and verification. The focus has until now been on academic conferences in Europe and the US, conferences monitored closely by the NSA. But only recently have computer networks and personal computers attained sufficient speed to make the idea practically realizable. And the next 10 years will bring enough additional speed to make the ideas economically feasible and essentially unstoppable. High-speed networks, ISDN, tamper-proof boxes, smart cards, satellites, Ku-band transmitters, multi-MIPS, personal computers, and encryption chips, now under development, will be some of the enabling technologies. The state will, of course, try to slow or halt the spread of this technology, citing national security concerns, use of the technology by drug dealers and tax evaders, and fear of societal disintegration. Many of these concerns will be valid. Crypto-anarchy will allow national secrets to be traded freely and will allow illicit and stolen materials to be traded. An anonymous computerized market will even make possible abhorrent markets for assassination and extortion. Various criminal and foreign elements will be active users of CryptoNet, but this will not halt the spread of crypto-anarchy. Just as the technology of printing altered and reduced the power of medieval guilds and the social power structure, so too will cryptologic methods fundamentally alter the nature of corporations and of government interference in economic transactions. Combined with emerging information markets, crypto-anarchy will create a liquid market for any and all materials which can be put into words and pictures. And just as a seemingly minor invention like barbed wire made possible the fencing off of vast ranches and farms, thus altering forever the concepts of land and property rights in the frontier West, so too will the seemingly minor discovery of an arcane branch of mathematics come to be the wire clippers which dismantle the barbed wire around intellectual property. Arise, you have nothing to lose but your barbed wire fences. And again, that's the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto, back from 1988, up by Timothy C. May. That's a Smash the State report here on AWOL Radio. Out of breath and out of time.